Sponsorship for this KQED live audio stream comes from Brevo, helping businesses work smarter, not harder, to help deliver customer experiences across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. Learn more at brevo.com. That's brevo.com.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. On today's program, after 30 years of military conflict, how do the people of Aceh deal with peace and justice? And China's bloggers find strength in numbers.
A Chinese blogger isn't going to be too influential. Many Chinese bloggers, on the other hand, can be very influential.
Pacific Time, reporting on the connections between Asia, America, and our Asian American communities. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Susie Racho. We begin today with our continuing series from Aceh, Indonesia. Aceh, at the northern tip of the island of Sumatra, was at the epicenter of the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. The disaster devastated the region, but surprisingly it brought peace and political change as well. The tragedy forced Acehese separatists and the Indonesian government to end 30 years of civil war. As we reported last week, Aceh held its first ever direct election on Monday, and though official results aren't going to be released until January, early indications are that a former rebel will be Aceh's new governor. Whoever it is will have a tough job rebuilding damage from the war and tsunami, not only houses and roads, but relationships and psyches. In the second part of our series from Aceh, Jocelyn Ford reports on the debate on how justice will be done.
Nur Sina is standing up to her knees in mud, planting rice. It's her neighbor's rice paddy. The 55-year-old will get paid just under $2 for the day's work. She's the main breadwinner for her family of five, a role she took on 7 years ago when her husband vanished. Nur Sina says one day her husband drove to a nearby town for business. He never came back. She believes he was killed because people suspected him of supporting the Free Aceh movement, the rebel group that was struggling for independence. She says he wasn't. Then, 2 years later, Nur Sina's 28-year-old son went out fishing. The villagers heard a scream.
Someone stabbed his eyes and cut off his hand and foot.
He died by the lake in his brother's arms. Again, no one claimed responsibility. Now there is peace in Aceh, but Nur Sina says even if she could find out who killed her husband and son, she doesn't want to punish them.
I'll give their lives to God, give Allah what He wants.
Her religion is helping her find closure.
In Islam, you are very much appreciated if you forgive those who commit crime to you. Yeah, the God is appreciate this kind of people.
Saifuddin Bantasyam is a law professor at Aceh's Shah Kuala University. He's done surveys on what victims of the conflict want. Many are forgiving, like Nur Sina.
But we will also find a number of family that very hard to forgive those accountable for human rights violation.
People like Umi Kasim. The quiet 30-year-old traveled 2 hours to attend a rally demanding financial compensation from the government. The government has promised to pay all victims, but the money is late, and that's not all she wants. During the conflict, she was raped by the military. Her husband was brutally beaten. He is no longer able to walk.
I want the attacker to feel exactly the same way I feel. So if someone was murdered, the perpetrator should also die.
15 months ago, the government of Indonesia and the separatist rebels signed a peace agreement. They agreed to demobilize fighters on both sides. The two sides also agreed to pursue justice for the many Achenese who suffered abuses and to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That's what South Africa did after apartheid.
Truth and Reconciliation Commission is set up not to determine guilt or innocence, but to ascertain the truth of what happened in the conflict.
Michelle Skaggs is coordinator of the Asia International Justice Initiative at the East-West Center in Hawaii.
The philosophy is that people come together to tell their stories, and the process, the act of doing that, brings some form of communal amelioration for the atrocities that occurred. I think in many ways it's more of a healing process for the parties who are telling the stories.
In Aceh, there are plenty of stories to be told. The conflict left at least 15,000 dead. Civilians suffered the most. A study co-authored by Harvard Medical School shows that in areas where fighting was most intense, people are carrying psychological scars comparable to those in Bosnia and Afghanistan. A quarter of Achenese men were tortured, and more than half of villagers witnessed violence against someone. Sometimes they had no idea who was the perpetrator, the military, the rebels, or someone else. But not everyone is sure that revisiting the traumatic experiences of the past is the best way to help the tens of thousands of victims find peace and get on with their lives. Professor of Islamic Studies Fuad Murtatila says some are afraid to retell their stories. They're afraid to point their finger at the Indonesian military.
It can create a new problem in the future. It can also create the angry spirit from the military, for example. They can also create a new conflict if we trying to dig again their bad experience.
Human rights activists worry the Indonesian government doesn't have the political will to go after its powerful army. The military has been accused of massive human rights abuses in Aceh and other parts of the country. And despite the pledge in the peace agreement, it is unlikely a Truth and Reconciliation Commission will be feasible anytime soon. Last week, a top Indonesian court ruled such a commission has no legal basis, and clauses offering amnesty and reparations are unconstitutional. So the law needs to be rewritten, which will take several years. One solution may be to revive Aceh's traditional methods of justice, methods that fell into disuse during the long period of civil war. Rudy Arianto is part of a movement to promote them. On this day, he's teaching a group of women who survived the tsunami about governing practices that date back centuries. They're gathered at a newly built traditional public meeting space called a munasa. It's a raised platform with a roof and open walls. They sit, some nursing newborns, within sight of where the sea came crashing down on their village, wiping away their homes and loved ones. Budi explains that before Western-style law courts, Aceh had its own system of settling disputes based on Islamic and local traditions. A religious leader and the village elders would hold a public hearing at the munasa. The perpetrator of a crime would confess, and the two parties would agree to compensation. Then they'd have a ceremony of forgiveness, perhaps slaughter a cow and invite all the village to a feast. This would demonstrate to everyone that they've made peace and restored village harmony.
This system is much faster than law and courts, and Achenese have more trust in their local leaders than they do in the Indonesian courts. Local leaders aren't corrupt.
Law professor Saifuddin Bantasyam says the old system has some advantages. For example, it's a lot cheaper than going to court, and it can help heal the community and preempt revenge attacks.
When we have no loser and winner from this process, we can avoid someone to take revenge. And also can then re-establish again the relationship that already broken.
But he says it's unlikely many of the people who committed serious human rights violations will participate. The military have been reassigned to elsewhere in Indonesia, and such records as there were of abuses were washed away with the tsunami. For Pacific Time, I'm Jocelyn Ford in Banda Aceh.
You can see pictures from Jocelyn Ford on our website, kqed.org/pacific time. Next week, 2 years after the tsunami, Has the enormous outpouring of aid from around the world made enough of a difference in rebuilding Aceh? 1.4 million Americans have something in common, though many of them don't know it. They're infected with hepatitis B, and over half of those infected are Asian Americans. Last week, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new guidelines to help stop the spread of Hep B. And while health advocates are pleased with the recommendations, some are worried that they don't go far enough. Pacific Times' Mina Kim has the story.
The CDC's new recommendations urge physicians to perform a hepatitis B test on every one of their patients who's an Asian American born outside the U.S. Hepatitis B has no symptoms, so infected people can pass it on unknowingly through unprotected sex or sharing contaminated needles. It also can be passed from mother to child at birth. If hepatitis B isn't detected and treated early, it can lead to liver cancer, which is often fatal. The rate of liver cancer is 9 times higher in Vietnamese Americans than whites, and 4 to 5 times higher in Chinese and Korean Americans. Dr. Samuel So is head of the Asian Liver Center at Stanford University.
We are pleased that the new recommendation actually incorporate some of the things we advocated.
Some, but not all. So was hoping the CDC's new guidelines would recommend not just testing for hepatitis B, but also universal vaccinations for all Asian Americans. That would make insurance companies more likely to cover the cost of vaccination, which is approximately $150.
Every week I see young people, many of them Asian Americans, coming to see me dying from advanced liver cancer when it could be prevented with a simple vaccine we have for over 20 years.
But what the CDC won't do, the city of San Francisco will. City Supervisor Fiona Ma, who herself has chronic hepatitis B, just sponsored legislation to offer testing and vaccination to all Asian American residents beginning as early as next spring. But city and state health departments have a lot of other demands on their limited budgets. They need more resources, says Dr. So. Last year, he helped draft the National Hepatitis B Act. It would have appropriated federal funding for more testing, vaccination, and treatment programs. But the bill never made it out of committee. So says the Asian American community has itself partly to blame.
A problem with the Asian American community is they don't speak out about this problem, and or they are not aware of it, or they assume someone is doing something about it.
He's hoping next year, with the CDC's new recommendations and a new Congress, the bill will go further.
The Asian American community has to rise up to write to the congressmen and senators to make sure they get passed and appropriated, right? Otherwise, it's just a futile exercise.
For Pacific Time, I'm Mina Kim.
This weekend in Delhi, India, bloggers from all over the world are converging, in person or virtually, for the 3rd annual Global Voices Online Bloggers Summit. The Global Voices website is an index of online diaries from bloggers living outside the U.S. and Europe. On a recent visit, I found posts about the customer service culture in Jamaica, a lost dog in Belgrade, and trying to find a cab in Chechnya. It's easier than at any time in human history to get that kind of peek into the lives of ordinary people. Of course, that freedom to communicate isn't always welcomed by governments that prefer to have their thumbs on the flow of information. China is home to an increasing number of tech-savvy bloggers finding ways to make their voices heard, even with governmental restrictions. Yuan Chan reports from Beijing.
Victor Hu, a stylish media consultant in his 20s, looks completely at home in a coffee shop in one of Beijing's yuppie heartlands.
Do you come to this coffee shop a lot?
Yeah, just like my part of my house. Everyone knows me. This cafe has been running for almost 1 year, and since the first day I got in here, so everyone knows me.
The cafe provides computer terminals and a free Wi-Fi connection. Victor opens up his laptop and clicks to show me his blog.
So it's loaded now?
Yes. So we've got photos here, music's here, profile over here.
Victor's blog, wistfully named Blue Sky, is one of the more than an estimated 34 million blogs in China. 30 times as many as 4 years ago when the blogging craze began to spread. Some experts predict the country could have 100 million bloggers by the end of 2007. Roland Sung has been watching the development of China's blogosphere. After he returned to Hong Kong from the United States, Sung wanted to familiarize himself with the events and issues in Greater China. He started a blog as a way to bookmark and save interesting articles he found on the net.
I seem to sense this great divergence of what a English-only reader is getting compared to someone reading in Chinese. As time went on, I thought instead of a personal indulgence on my blog, it could be actually a public service. So that's when I really started going into doing translations from Chinese into English, hoping that the English-only reader can get a glimpse of what the Chinese readers are seeing every day.
In just 3 years, Sung's blog, East, South, Northwest, has become a leading source of online information about current events and cultural trends in China, often picking up on news before it reaches the mainstream media. On it, readers can find Sung's comments on and impeccable translations of articles and analyses from the Chinese media, the Chinese blogosphere, chat rooms, and other China-related sites. The bookish and boyish-looking 57-year-old is particularly interested in the ever-increasing number of blogs written by Chinese media people.
In China, what really interests me is because you can have a control on what appears in the mainstream media, but that doesn't mean the media workers are silent, because these days they keep their own blogs. It's something that I don't see in the U.S., In the U.S., reporters don't feel as if they need to inform anyone about, let's say, all the little compromises that they have to make in the line of duty.
China's bloggers aren't completely free to write exactly what they want. Chinese blog hosting companies use keyword filters to search for and delete sensitive postings. Some blogs have been closed down, and some bloggers have even been arrested. But with so many increasingly tech-savvy bloggers and sophisticated readers out there, the blogosphere is still a space for a great diversity, if not cacophony, of Chinese voices. And those voices can make an impact. Earlier this year, Foxconn, a Taiwanese company manufacturing Apple iPods, dropped a 30 million yuan lawsuit against two mainland journalists for alleged misreporting on labor conditions in a Guangdong factory.
A Chinese blogger isn't going to be too influential. Many Chinese bloggers, on the other hand, can be very influential. By that I mean you're going to need a unifying course, or the media worker bloggers were unified. That becomes all Foxconn all the time. And everyone speaks out, and it's self-amplification. It gets louder and louder until the point when Foxconn realizes this was a no-win situation and it backed off.
But it would be a mistake to see China's blogosphere as just a seething mass of dissent or political or even cultural envelope pushing. Back in the coffee shop, Victor Hu walks me through his blog. As photos of Victor in poses fit for a fashion magazine flicker on the screen, he tells me what his blog means to him.
You know, blog, to me, this is a place to see and to be seen, you know. And in my blogs, all the articles is all about peace and love. I want to share my experience with my friends. And also I want to just leave some prints on the way, like maybe 40 or 50 years later, I could still log on the web and read those articles that I wrote years and years ago and share my happiness and sadness with my grandson or whatever.
But the media consultant also recognizes the commercial potential of blogs.
More and more people and more agency or companies are using bloggers as a communication vehicle. I do think blogs is really powerful. Like, you know, nowadays viral communication is really popular.
In fact, the latest craze in China is for celebrity blogs. The online diary of actress and director Su Jinglei on the portal Sina.com has already become the most widely read blog in the world, already surpassing 10 million hits. And as Roland Sung notes, when celebs and commerce join hands, advertising revenues can't be far away. For Pacific Time, I'm Yuan Chan in Beijing.
One news event that bloggers and most everyone else in the U.S. have been following over the last few weeks is the story of the Kim family of San Francisco. They were returning from a Thanksgiving trip in the Pacific Northwest when they got lost in the Oregon Mountains and their car became stuck in heavy snow. After 7 days, James Kim left his wife and two little girls in their car and struck out on foot, ultimately walking 16 miles in search of help. Rescuers found Kim's family, but weren't able to get to him in time to save his life. The tragic death of James Kim touched all those that followed his story, including blogger and podcaster Carmen Van Kerkhove, who has the first of two reflections.
I didn't know him, but it seemed like we could easily have run in the same circles. I'm just a couple years younger than him, also Asian, not quite the tech evangelist he was, but I definitely have my geeky streak. Apart from those attributes, what made me feel a special connection with James, Katie, and their two daughters was that they were an interracial family just like mine, just like the families of many of my friends. And I just don't see families like ours on TV very often. Sure, there are more and more TV shows featuring interracial couples. Think of Grey's Anatomy or Heroes. But the focus is solely on the couple. We don't get to see what that relationship looks like after the excitement of a new romance wears off, when children enter the picture, when the world no longer revolves around just two people, when love becomes something bigger. But that's exactly what we saw in the photos of the Kim family. It was hard to take your eyes off those pictures. They were so vivid and colorful, the warmth and joy practically leapt off the screen. Like the photo of James in the park, holding his adorably chubby baby daughter, smiling as he looked to the side while his other daughter stands in the background, pensively chewing on a piece of candy. Or the other photo, with the baby resting peacefully on James's chest, while Katie looks on with a loving and protective gaze. Race was never discussed in the media coverage of the Kim family's disappearance, but the pictures spoke loud and clear. And to those of us from mixed families, it was a powerful affirmation to see a reflection of our own families in the Kims. It was also a powerful affirmation to hear about James's heroism. I was amazed when I read about what he had done to save his wife and children. He ventured into the bitter cold, wearing only street clothes. He covered miles of treacherous terrain, and all along the way, he dropped personal items so that a search team would have some way of tracking him. James had strength, determination, loyalty, love, intelligence, and resourcefulness. To me, he will always set the bar for what it means to be a real man.
Carmen Van Kerkhove is the co-founder of New Demographic, an anti-racism training company in New York.
My name is Chris Tashima. I'm an actor and director in Los Angeles. In my quest for decent roles as an Asian American actor, I've always felt, forced myself to believe that when you get right down to it, the American movie-going public doesn't care so much about race as film industry practices might seem to imply, that the race or ethnicity of the star of a film, whether heroic or romantic, isn't the factor that will determine a film's success or even its acceptance. It's the characters themselves. It's the story. In other words, hey, heroes and romantic leads don't always have to be white guys. They can be Asian, black, Latino, or whatever. If I didn't believe this, I'd have to walk away from acting or the possibility of any decent career. But every once in a while, there'll be some evidence that it's worth my maintaining this belief. James Kim's story did that for me. I think like many Asian Americans, I've grown up with so few instances of representation in the media, whether in entertainment or in the news, that I'm hungry for it. So this story immediately caught my eye, being that in the center of the family photos being broadcast on TV, when this family's disappearance first hit the news, was an Asian man. As tragic as his story is, James Kim is serving the Asian American community in a positive and powerful way. He's being called such a great co-worker, friend, and father by those who knew him. That in itself is significant counter-representation to all the negative stereotypes we're so familiar with. But even more than that, it's the fact that he has touched so many people. That it seems this entire nation feels for his family, and that actually race has been no issue at all. Now, one may think, of course, race has nothing to do with this story, but for me, that's my point. His story is a human one. It's appealed to all of us in a universal way, and the media hasn't cared that he was Korean-American. So inadvertently and privately, James Kim has become a role model for me. I mean, in many ways, he was just an average Joe, but people liked him. It's amazing how much his story has connected with people, and I think that's a tribute to who he was. He transcended boundaries. I did not know James Kim, but his story has inspired me. Thanks to him, I will continue to walk forward in my career and in my life proudly. Thank you, my Asian
brother. Krista Shima is an award-winning actor and director living in Los Angeles. That's it for this edition of Pacific Time. If you missed a story, don't worry. You can listen to us anytime at kqed.org/pacific time. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown and performed by him and the Asian American Orchestra. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Seal Muller, Sarah Bond, Robin Takayama, Pat Flynn, RJ Lozada, Howard Gelman, Danny Bringer, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Susie Racho. Thanks for joining us.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.